Jim Grierson.
And hi, I'm Will Leach, and this is the Grierson Leach Podcast, episode 43 here at the New Republic. Grierson, now listen, we're not going to start singing a Leonard Cohen song or anything, but we would be lying if we, like a large part of the rest of the country, one would might even say a majority of the rest of the country, mathematically speaking, are still a little bit shaken by the events of last Tuesday. I pseudo-joked about it on Twitter that it felt a little on, I had to get a flight on Wednesday morning after being up very late watching the world collapse. I joked that it was very strange to go and do like routine things, like the same way that like people on, like you'd always hear Jon Stewart the day after like a school shooting. It always felt like really weird to go on and try to be funny. You know, I was like, should we even go on the air today? And I have to say it's very strange because it has now been almost a week since Election Day and I still kind of feel that way a little bit, but we're going to work our way through it and try to pull it together. How are you hanging then, Grierson? You with me on that?
Yeah, I have to say that I have, for me, what's been strange is not wanting to be on social media and just kind of, I've been very much in a cave, I have to say, of just kind of processing and thinking and not doing a lot of kind of outward response to anything. And I almost feel like I can't possibly even comprehend what's occurred.
Also a little bit of, to be honest, doing a lot of the normal social media stuff kind of feels like contributing to the problem a little bit, to be honest. That's a larger discussion for a larger time. But that kind of contentious, angry stuff, I don't know, it feels kind of like, obviously it's not the only thing that's led to this, but it's certainly, I will say also, this has been a record week for me reading tweets of people that are like, I just need to get off social media for a while. I'm just going to take a break. I need to chill out. It's been a record week for that. And I think, frankly, regardless of what happened on Tuesday, that's not necessarily the worst instinct of the world.
Yes, I would agree. For me, what's, I think, very interesting is it's watching a group of people collectively grieve in very different ways is and sometimes them having discussions with each other about what are the proper ways to grieve and thinking, you know, I think people should just be allowed to process this as they want. So,
yes. So, all right. So we're just going to go ahead and do a movie podcast. And of course, we've talked about politics and many times this podcast, because frankly, if you're talking, one of the things that's always very strange to me coming from the world of sports is when people always say, oh, please keep your politics out of my sports or keep your politics out of my movies, as if politics can possibly be kept out of anything. So it seems kind of willfully obtuse, but certainly I will say it will not, I won't mind talking about an alien movie for a little bit, but we'll put it that way, even if it is doggone it annoyingly a thoughtful one. So this is the Grierson Podcast, episode 43. We're going to pull it together and kick it today. We remind you to please follow us on Twitter at Grierson Leach, GRIERSONLEITCH. Expect fewer tweets this week, but eventually we'll be back.
I was actually thinking this week, you know, we should let the listeners know what our next upcoming reboot movie is. And I thought, good God, why would I Why would anybody care about that?
We could put that up and everyone just, I mean, if everyone just collectively screamed at us, nobody gives a shit, that would be like totally fine. Right. No one would complain. Anyway, but if you would do want to play along in our little game, find us on SoundCloud, find us, of course, at newrepublic.com and subscribe to us on iTunes. Please give us a review on iTunes. If you do give us a review on iTunes and list the name of a movie you would like us to talk about, we will talk about it in our reboot section. This week, we have one reboot movie. It comes to us from Joshua J16, refreshingly relatable criticism. 5 stars. I watch a lot of movies, writes Joshua J16, and consume a lot of criticism. That makes me sound like Joshua J16 makes a lot of mistakes. People are just criticizing him all the time.
And that dress, it's awful. Yes.
Joshua J16 is like, I can't consume all this criticism. Anyway, and it's frustrating when it feels like critics are being extremely highbrow just for the sake of being highbrow. Even when I don't agree with Will and or Tim, they explain themselves so well that I have no doubt that their opinions are sincere and well thought out, which makes listening to the podcast such an informative and fun experience. I would love to hear them review my favorite movies of the last 5 years. They introduced it to a ton of young talent. Short Term 12. Keep up the great work. So in our reboot section, we will be discussing Short Term 12. However, we have 2 in-depth movies to talk about this week, and then one I'm going to ask briefly Grierson a few questions about. The first movie to kick us off this week is Arrival.
The object touched down 40 minutes ago.
Mama, what's going to happen?
I don't know.
Dr. Banks, you're at the top of everyone's list when it comes to translations. You hear any words?
Is that?
Yes.
Am I the only one having trouble saying aliens?
Arrival is the new sci-fi, not thriller maybe, but sci-fi drama by director Denis Villeneuve, who recently made Enemy, which was my favorite of his movies before his new movie, spoiler alert. It stars Amy Adams as a linguist named Louise, who is summoned by the U.S. government once an alien vessel arrives on Earth. The military, basically run by Forrest Whitaker in the movie, wants her to try to make contact with the alien vessel. Along the way, she meets up with another scientist, played by Jeremy Renner. And the bulk of the movie, I would say, is essentially a realistic, if that is the correct word, treatment of what would happen if aliens actually came to Earth and how humanity would respond to it. I think it's important to mention, and this will probably not be the last time this type of comment comes up from the two of us. I saw this movie weeks ago, and I saw it before the election. And so I can't speak to how people have been feeling about this movie since the election and since this movie has come out this weekend. But with that being said, I think this movie is pretty darn terrific. And one of the things I like about it so much is specifically this idea of how would one actually go about trying to make contact with aliens, and what would that step-by-step process be? How would humanity respond to it, and what would they do once they got certain information? If you haven't seen this movie, I would actually strongly recommend not reading reviews, because one of the problems I've actually had with a lot of the reviews, even for people who like this movie, is they talk about it in terms of it being a twist or a riddle or a puzzle. I don't think that's the right way to go into this movie, though I understand describing that movie this way. I think the best way to watch this movie is simply as sort of a detective story, frankly. It's about this woman who really doesn't have much in her life, but she's this brilliant linguist, and she's trying to unravel the alien language and trying to figure out what they're actually here on Earth to do. Are they trying to help us? Are they trying to enslave us? What's going on? And I think that's actually the best way to watch this movie, because I think what happens in the story and the different twists and perhaps even, say, surprises, I think are much more emotional and effective because of that. I've always been a big Amy Adams fan. We've both been big Amy Adams fans for quite some time. This is one of the best things she's done in terms of a mainstream movie. I feel like Hollywood, especially movies like Batman vs. Superman, have not exactly figured out what to do with Amy Adams. I feel like this movie actually does. I think she is really smart and really sensitive and just very, very interesting in this film. This filmmaker is not one who I have necessarily liked all that much. I was not a big fan of his War on Drugs film because that movie always to me felt like it was trying to teach me a lesson I already knew. I was not a big fan of his movie Prisoners, which also I felt like was trying to teach me a lesson that I already knew. This movie, I was very concerned when I saw it, would be a movie about, don't you see, we've all got to come together. And though there is an element of that to this movie, I actually found it to be much more intelligent and nuanced. And the final thing I'll say about this film is that for people like me who thought that Christopher Nolan's film Interstellar was incredibly grand in a lot of ways, but sort of emotionally lacking, this is that movie I wished Interstellar had been. I like this movie quite a lot.
Yeah, I liked it quite a lot too. And one of the things I really admire about the movie, and I think it's a step forward for him, because I like him a little bit more than you do, but I see a lot of the same issues. We've talked about some of the issues we've had with him in the past. But the thing, there's a little bit of, I saw this in Sicario too, there's a little bit of show-offiness to him, or a little bit of he likes you to know he's a serious and a really talented director. And one of the things I really like about this movie is he finds something, and again, you're right, it's not a twist, it's not anything that I actually refer to it in my review for The New Republic as, it's a mystery. Like, that's what this movie is. It's a sci-fi mystery. And but one of the things I like about it so much is you can almost sense that he intellectually was enticed by the idea of, structurally speaking, how he puts together this mystery and how he makes it work with the movie. But the thing that's great about it is it actually does pack a legitimate emotional punch. And that is something that I don't think has been a strength of even his good movies in a lot of ways. So for him to kind of like work that technical skill and still, and this is a movie, while I think it does have a big emotional payoff, it never feels like it's cheating for one. It's very funny. I was on iTunes before this podcast. And of course, you know, iTunes, a lot of times when there's a new movie coming out, a wide release movie, they'll find a movie that they feel is thematically similar or has some sort of connection to that movie. And they'll like put it up as a sale on their front page. And this time it was Contact. They put up Contact. I guess they just decided science fiction movie and female protagonist. And one of the many great things about Arrival is how non-contact-y it is.
Boy, like ain't that the truth? Yes.
Yeah. Like, it's not. It's not gushy. It's not. They said it's in a poet. Like, it is very matter of fact about what you're, as you put it, what would happen, how this would go down, how people would react, how there's a little bit, particularly in the Michael Stuhlbarg character, there's a little bit of that like Die Hard problem of, this movie needs someone that's just wrong about everything so our protagonist can constantly be right about everything. There's a little bit of that, but not so much so that it feels overdone. And frankly, I think the movie actually handles, I find it of note that the Chinese government in this movie seems to have its head screwed on straight a little bit better than the U.S. government does. But, you know, maybe that's just because I saw it after the election. But I think that one of the things I really like about that is it gets you into the nuts and bolts of it. It never feels like it's cheating. The scenes with the aliens are, there are times where it's really impressive. There's a very cool scene. The way that they actually approach the ship is like shot in a cool way, and that gives you kind of that, it delivers the good in that regard while still being, never being heavily CGI. It's actually a fairly low budget for a big Hollywood movie like this. And I think the aliens themselves are impressive in a not so much grand way, but in frankly what it seems like realistically, what the almost unimpressive but still mysterious way. And the way that's structured and the way we all react to it and the way everyone handles it is so matter of fact and so non-overly emotional that that side of the story, which is very vital to what's coming. And again, I'm careful. I feel like I'm trying to be very careful to discuss it, even in this podcast, to make sure that I don't give anything away. The way that sneaks its way into the story, I found deeply satisfying.
Yeah, I did too. You know, people who know me know I'm a big fan of Shutter Island. One of the fights I always get into with people is that they'll say, oh, well, I knew the twist coming in that movie. And so because I knew that, that negates what that movie's trying to say. My argument with that movie is always, well, it actually, the twist doesn't matter once you've seen the movie one time, because when you see it multiple times, it adds an extra level of emotional complexity to what's going on in that film. And I would say that the same thing, I've only seen Arrival once, but I have a funny feeling that you could see this movie multiple times and that won't make a difference. And if anything, would add to the experience. The one thing I would say about the Chinese government being pretty decent is, of course, I thought to myself, well, they're making sure that the Chinese market is happy, you know, in terms of like overseas right. commercial success and like that. I also say, because Enemy was my favorite of his movies before this one, there's a great Enemy shout out. There's there's a great reference in the movie, which I very much enjoyed. The last thing I would, or one of the last things I want to mention is that there was a documentary that came out a couple of years ago that barely got a release called The Visit. And I just want to give it a quick shout out because if you find this movie intriguing, I highly recommend it because in that documentary, the idea is, okay, aliens come to Earth. What would the nations of the world do? And so what the documentary filmmakers do is they interview a bunch of different people, whether it's scientists or philosophers or people at the UN, and say, okay, talk us through this. Aliens show up. What happens? What's the procedure? And that movie has kind of a great twist to it too that I don't want to say, but it's actually really kind of fascinating how that movie also kind of deals with this idea of, so basically who's in charge of the Earth and being our spokesperson. And Arrival deals with that a little bit, but not quite so much. So I would say if people like Arrival, they should definitely check out that movie as well, because I think they kind of speak to each other in kind of a cool way.
Yeah, and you know, one of the things, the quiet little themes of Arrival that I think is important, and again, I saw it after the election, so maybe this was more on my mind, but one of the things I think is very powerful about the movie is, you know, for a sci-fi movie where, you know, we've seen, you know, how the humans will handle it and how they will battle each other as they handle the aliens and so on, one of the things I really love about this movie is this is really just a movie about communication. Like, this is about the importance of communication, the importance of listening, the importance of patience, and the importance of taking the time to get the full message that is being sent in your direction and stepping outside of yourself and your own issues and figuring out what you are trying to be told and trying to understand it. And that is, you know, I don't want to turn every one of our reviews for the next 4 years into the more you know moment, but I will say that's something that I did find resonant seeing it when I did.
Yeah, and I would also say that one of the strengths of this movie is that whenever you work in the sci-fi world, there's going to be a certain moment in the film where the filmmakers have to deviate from science to either make an emotional point or to make something more dramatic. And this movie, if I cared to think about it, probably has a couple where someone would say, oh, well, wait a second, that doesn't make sense, or that actually falls apart once you unravel it. The strength of this movie is that I would tell those people to shut up, because I think that emotionally it's coherent, and that is to me more important than maybe certain logic or like science-y issues.
Well, I do love it when you tell people to shut up. I'm not going to lie to you. You don't do it often enough. Not to me. Don't you ever say it to me.
Yes. You should come over and see how I've been the last few days. And then the other thing I just want to say real fast, because I'm a geek about this. I actually interviewed the production designer and the visual effects supervisor for this movie, and I had to ask them. I said, listen, I'm a big fan of the visual artist James Turrell. I have to know if like part of the ship's design was inspired by that. And they said, oh yeah, are you kidding? Like, we're big James Turrell fans. And so that was a huge influence. For people who aren't familiar with James Turrell, if you've seen Drake's video for Hotline Bling, the way that those like sharp, strong colors are used in that video is very much an homage to James Turrell, and the inside of the spaceship in Arrival is very much that way as well. It's just, and this is the thing I think that he as a filmmaker does really well, even when I don't like his movies. They're designed beautifully. And this movie, especially because it's working on kind of all cylinders, the look and the design of it kind of works in concert with everything else, where you feel like, oh, this movie has been thought through I know I keep using this movie to badger or kind of smack down Interstellar, but as designed as that movie was, you got the sense that it wasn't entirely thought through. This movie feels pretty coherent and concise in terms of what it's trying to say.
All right, so what'd you give it?
I give it an A-.
Wow. Yeah, I give it a B+. I still feel like there's a little bit too much. The Michael Stuhlbarg character is kind of just lousy.
Like that. Yes.
It's amazing how, I mean, you know how much I love A Serious Man. It's amazing. Like, when's the last time you really liked him in a movie?
Well, I have to tell you that I have seen Miss Sloane, and he is also in that, and he also has don't tell me this is what he's going to do now. He's going to be that guy. Especially after he was so great in Men in Black 3, frankly, I actually thought, oh, he's going to find some cool roles. And yeah, like you, I'm a big Serious Man fan too. And I'm like, oh, come on. Someone's got to find him something good because he can do it.
It's a stupid part. And it's the one part of the movie that the way that part's kind of structured and the way really there's all this skepticism. I also feel like the Renner character doesn't pop. Like, I feel like he's fine and he does the job. And maybe that's just Amy Adams being so, because she's so good in this. The Renner character feels more like a convenient, I'm a scientist and I sort of prop notion, which didn't really bother me so much, but kept it from that top tier for me.
Would you say that it's Jeremy Renner-esque? Because I would respectfully submit that that does seem to be a lingering problem in terms of his performances. That there is I don't want to say a blandness, but there is a lack of pop, I feel like, in a lot of his performances. And I think it also kind of comes through, though it didn't bother me, I don't think, quite as much as it did you. But
it didn't bother me so much. It just it kept it for a story that, again, is about the heart and so on. I feel like that's an element of the movie that doesn't quite entirely land. But listen, obviously, we both really like Arrival, so people should go see Arrival.
So now, what should we do? Should we talk about Loving?
I'm gonna build you a house. Right here. Our house.
I wanna take Mildred up to DC and get married.
Are you sure about that?
By the power vested in me by the District of Columbia, I now pronounce you husband and wife.
Loving is written and directed by Jeff Nichols, stars Joel Edgerton, Ruth Negga, Nick Kroll, and Michael Shannon, very briefly. It is the story of Richard Loving and Mildred Loving. Richard Loving is a white man in the late 50s who falls in love with Mildred, who is a black woman, in the late 50s in Virginia. And as it turns out, they fall in love, but they keep their marriage very secret. They end up going off to Washington, D.C. to get married, but still keep it secret. Someone finds out about it. It's kind of implied that one of her neighbors finds out and calls the police, because in the state of Virginia, it is in fact illegal for a black man, for an interracial marriage or interracial relationships were illegal in the late 50s. So they are sentenced then to 1 year in prison, or if they were to leave the state of Virginia for 25 years. Now, they are from a very rural area, but they moved to Washington, D.C. so they can remain married. It turns out to be very difficult, particularly for Mildred, who's very close to her family. So they end up coming back to Virginia, end up getting them arrested, and ends up leading to ultimately a large-scale court case about the Lovings to set down these miscegenation laws, which I can never say correctly. And there's a lawyer played by Nick Kroll in a serious role. I guess he's always serious. He's just often funny while he's serious. Nick Kroll plays a lawyer who argues to the Supreme Court, uses their case as an example to fight against these laws. Now, I'm a little wary in talking about Loving about the court case, because one of the things I like so much about this movie, and we've talked about Jeff Nichols a lot on this podcast, I think it's the third Jeff Nichols movie we have discussed on this podcast. One of the reasons I wanted to make sure we had a discussion of this movie is because he's become such a large, I mean, he's done like a 15th of our shows have now been about Jeff Nichols, so we should probably give him his full airing. But one of the things that I like about this so much is the Supreme Court case. The reason that we know about the Lovings in the first place, or the reason they are making a movie about the Lovings in the first place, is almost this like quiet, not even a subplot, but this thing that's going alongside on a parallel track to the actual story, which is this is just a really fantastic love story. This is a terrific love story between two people who have this kind of overpowering love for one another, but it is so simple. They kind of take their cues. Richard, who's played by Joel Edgerton, he is kind of a basic guy. He doesn't seem to really understand. There's a lot about the relationship and really about the world that he seems to either not understand or not care to understand about. All that matters is that he loves Mildred. So therefore, he's no matter what happens, as in the tradition of people in love for centuries and centuries and millennia, he just wants to be with this woman and will do whatever it takes to do so. But he seems to he has no interest in being any sort of poster boy for interracial marriage or any sort of advocate or anything. He just wants to be with the woman he loves and to raise a family that he loves. And that the simplicity of their story speaks to why I remember when I first heard about this movie. You know, we're big Jeff Nichols fans. I found it cute. This felt like, oh, so is Jeff Nichols trying to win an Oscar? Like, this feels like it felt like this is the big message movie in a way that one of the things I like about Jeff Nichols is he's done all these different kinds of movies and he's shown all these different kinds of abilities to do all these different kinds of things. Even when some movies like Mud, for example, I'm not as crazy about as other people are. But the thing, and so now to see the movie, and there is a little bit of that. There's still the big court case, and they still go to the Supreme Court. The thing that shines through is strong, and the one thing that Jeff Nichols understands profoundly, and really almost all of his movies are at the core kind of about, is the idea of, we actually criticized this a little bit when we talked about Midnight Special, his last movie. He understands and is deeply moved by family and faith and dedication and loyalty to your family and the importance and how you will do anything you can to protect the people that you are closest to and care the most about. And that story, the story of them, is so simple and it's so straightforward, but it finds, you know, it's funny, in a lot of Jeff Nichols movies, there's always some sort of menace that seems to be just coming in from the edge of the screen. And this movie does such a great job of that, of almost normalizing how scary the circumstances that surround the Lovings, and how there are times that you just want to, like, guys, like, get out of Virginia, like, you guys need to be together, and you worry about them, and you worry about them losing each other or losing their family. You find to care very deeply for them. But Ruth Negga is very good, but I really feel like this is a terrific performance by Joel Edgerton. He just kind of strips away any kind of mess and just plays this simple guy who wants to be happy and will do anything he can protect the ones he loves. So this is not a perfect movie. This is not my favorite Jeff Nichols movie, but I find the central tenet at the middle of the story, which is their relationship and how powerful that is and how much they are dedicated to each other and their family, so kind of pure and perfect that the Supreme Court stuff I think is a little less interesting, and which of course is the reason for the movie, but I find a little bit less interesting, and therefore it's a reason I don't love as much the other Jeff Nichols movies, but I feel that part's so powerful that I was very much pro-loving.
I've seen this movie twice now. I saw it at Cannes when it premiered, and I saw it for us to write for The New Republic, my review, very recently, a couple weeks ago. And I have no issue with anything that you just said.
Awesome. Okay, we're done.
We're done. I just don't feel it that deeply, I have to say. This is a movie that I intellectually completely get and completely understand, and it makes a lot of sense. And for the most part, I think Nichols takes this in the right direction and uses the right approach, because as you mentioned, I also kind of worried, so is this his, like, screw it, I'm going for an Oscar type of thing? And it's not that. It's much more stripped down. It is defiantly and blessedly so. It refuses to have big speeches, big moments, big courtroom scenes. It doesn't do any of that. Nobody ever really says anything that you can play during the Oscar ceremony when that person is up for a nomination. Like when they do those, like, you know, the five best actors or the five best actresses, there's nothing in this movie that you can look at and be like, oh, that's the speech that they're going to use. And I really, really appreciate that Nichols does that. I do like the movie. I want to make that clear. But I think my overriding problem with the film, now seeing it twice, frankly, is I don't think that Nichols entirely figures out another way to do this movie. This, to me, feels like a movie that is about making sure you don't make one type of movie, as opposed to making a movie that is, in fact, its own movie. It feels like it's not this, and it's not this, and it's not this. And I find myself thinking, but I'm not exactly sure what's left is as great as I wished it was. This is my least favorite of his five movies. The thing I have loved about his previous four movies is that they were so specific to their worlds, and he so understood the characters and was able to kind of like make them feel so incredibly real that it was almost like there was an immediacy to those movies that was sort of hard to shake. This movie kind of does that, but my feeling is that while I understand that there's an idea that these two characters just really love each other and that's enough, I found myself feeling a bit restless with the stateliness and the reserve that this movie has. To me, it's almost too tasteful. There was a part of me that actually, both times I saw it, I thought, I actually kind of wish it was a little more Oscar-y in certain ways, because I don't think that outside of the two of them, there are a lot of great performances in this movie. I think there are fine performances. You know, Bill Camp, as always, is terrific. Nick Kroll actually doesn't bother me as much. I know a lot of people find him distracting. I actually like Nick Kroll in this movie. I think he's sort of fun. But to me, the movie kind of cuts both ways, because I think what does work for the film is that the film is so quiet and so simple. And the underlying point of that is these people just want to live their lives, and they're just ordinary, everyday people. But there's this horrible injustice in the world that won't allow them to be what they want and to live the life they want. And so while this movie is calm on the surface, think about what's going on. Think about what is happening in this movie. And I think that that is effective. But there is also almost it's almost too studied in terms of how it does it. Now, with that being said,
do you want it to be angrier? I guess that is what you want?
Well, I guess the thing I was going to just kind of conclude with is I think that where it gets to, the final scene in this movie, which I won't talk about or won't say much about, only after watching it the second time did I realize there's actually two things going on in the final scene that is connecting to two things from earlier in the movie. And there's like these motifs that are so quiet that you don't notice them. And then when they come back at the end in the final scene, you go, oh, right. That's what this has been about this entire time. I have enormous respect for this movie, but I have to be honest that both times I've watched it, I felt like, because I've never had that problem with his other movies, because they're quiet and they're small scale in their own ways, but those movies all kind of destroyed me. This movie, as much as I respect it, it doesn't destroy me in the same way.
You know, I can see one part of what you're talking about in maybe a lesser way than you do, in that while those other movies are quiet, like this one is, they feel under the surface very passionate. They feel, you know, I think Take Shelter is the best example of that. But even when his movies are taking their time and being reserved, there is always something bubbling underneath. And it's something that Nichols clearly, personally, feels very strongly about. And obviously, I'm sure he feels very strongly about that Black people and white people should be able to get married. Like, I'm not saying he doesn't feel that way, but I think certainly their scenes, it feels like you can see him looking at this idea, looking at this story, and this, he wrote the script for this. It's something that he's clearly connected to, but you can see him looking at this and finding much more power from their relationship than the story of why we should know about them. And it's why it's weird. It's funny because I want to talk about the Michael Shannon character a little bit, actually. Michael Shannon comes in, he has one scene, He plays a photographer from Life magazine, and he's Michael Shannon, so everything he does is just fascinating in kind of this off-kilter way. Literally, honestly, Batman vs. Superman is the only thing I've ever not enjoyed him in, and I've seen him in a lot of bad movies. And the guy never comes at it from a dull place, is probably the way to put it. And so, and I like his scenes, and he brings a little zest to the movie. Clearly, it's the first time the movie feels a little lopsided, in a way that a lot, in a good way. Like, it's the first time the movie gets a little hitch in its giddy up, I suppose, in a way that that Nichols movies always kind of has. But it still feels so weirdly out of place. It feels almost as much of an intrusion on their lives and the world of this movie than when the cops come. Like, it feels like this movie, like its main character, takes its cue from its main character so much. And I mean Richard, not Mildred, that he's so low key and just wants to be left alone, that it almost feels like when the outside world comes in, for good or ill, whether it's Nick Kroll or whether it's Michael Shannon or whether it's the evil sheriff, it all feels like an unsettling of the way things are supposed to be. They just want to be left alone and to be with one another. I find that on one hand, that's a little, I understand your need for more passion there. I understand your need for that kind of riling up. But I appreciate and respect and admire the decision that he made to just filter all of this through how he sees Richard, and to see himself as he sees Richard, much as he's often seen himself in the Michael Shannon characters in his movies. I respect him. That's how he decided to do this movie, to focus just solely, not just on their relationship, but how Richard kind of sees their relationship. And I found that a pretty impressive way to try it, even while I understand that it can feel almost like there's a governor on it.
Yeah, there is a not even a withholding, but there is something about that didn't entirely work for me. The Shannon stuff I love in the movie. I think it's actually terrific, because that is one of the best scenes of somebody from the outside seeing them. And there's something about those moments when he's taking pictures of them when they're on the couch together that really hit me, because there's a sense of other people being able to look at these two people and say, wow, they're really in love, aren't they? And so for me, I actually find, I agree that that is the one kind of wavy line in the movie, like that those scenes and like that. As I've said before in this podcast, I think that Michael Shannon is always well served by Jeff Nichols, and I would love if they would just make movies together, because I think Shannon, those guys get each other and they know how to do it. I think Nega and I think Edgerton are both quite good in it. It's interesting, because this to me goes back to the thing that we've talked about in the past. It's an accomplished filmmaker doing a very precise thing, and they know what they're doing. I think as a viewer, one has to acknowledge that the filmmaker knows what he's doing. This is not a thing where it's like, hey, buddy, you screwed up. Like, why did you make your movie like this? So I think it really is the question of how does the viewer respond to it. And I was actually very curious to see it the second time, because it had been months since I had seen it, and liked it better the second time, but still kind of walked away with that same feeling of it's almost a touch too dry. As Judy Davis said in Husbands and Wives, Will, metabolically, it's just not my rhythm.
Yeah. But are you the fox or am I the hedgehog? I can never quite remember.
tune in next week when we.
Yeah, cliffhanger. All right, Chris, what'd you give it?
I give it a B minus.
Yeah, I give it a B plus. Well, that's pretty. So this is definitely your least favorite Jeff Nichols movie.
It is. Yes.
Yeah, I would not say it is my favorite Jeff Nichols movie, but I do think it's very strong. And I just think he's another one of those filmmakers that can kind of do anything. And I think this is another example of it. So that is Loving. Now, briefly, we're going to talk. I have not seen this movie yet. I don't know if it's something that, unlike Loving, which we held off for this week, I don't know if it's a movie the two of us need to discuss. But I do want to briefly talk about it. So we're going to briefly talk about Billy Lynn's Long Halftime Walk.
I've still got a long walk ahead of me.
And I will be waiting for you.
What do we owe the pleasure of your enlistment, Private Lynn?
Sorry, excuse for warrior, I'm turning out to be.
Make it about something bigger than yourself.
These men are fighters. Let your training guide you.
this it?
It's going down.
What?
Let's go!
Joe's been hit! Dylan Lynn, cover him!
All right, Kristen, I got three movies about Billy Lynn's halftime walk, which, of course, is directed by Ang Lee, stars Joe Alwyn, Kristen Stewart, Chris Tucker, Vin Diesel, and Steve Martin. Finally, those five people in a room together.
Finally. It only took 120 FPS to bring them together.
Yes. So I guess this is, I just want to ask you first off, one of the movie is about a guy who's come back from Iraq and survives a very difficult battle and is honored at halftime of a quote unquote Dallas football team game.
And wink, wink.
Yeah. Exactly. And with an owner who is not Jerry Jones. So he is honored at halftime of the game. Of course, while he's being honored, there's kind of these flashbacks back and forth to his time during the war. So the first question, though, I really feel like we just kind of have to start with this. One of the more daring things that Ang Lee does with this movie is he makes this movie in 120 frames per second. Now, Grierson, I imagine the average listener of a movie podcast has some sense of what we're talking about in that. But just for the sake of frame of reference, The Hobbit, which I think is probably the most high profile movie that did a different frame rate, was not even this many frames per second, correct?
Yeah, that was 48 FPS. A standard traditional movie is 24 frames per second.
So why did he do, watching the movie, why did he do that? And does it work or is it too distracting?
One of the reasons why he did it is because when he made Life of Pi, his last movie, which was in 3D, he was frustrated because he really liked the 3D technology, but was frustrated that 24 frames per second would create all these blurring motion problems when characters would move. When you would see characters, you couldn't see them clearly when they moved. And so he wanted to do a faster frame rate. He initially was going to make a boxing movie with 120 frames per second because he felt like that would be a way to really capture fast motion. That would be the type of material that would lend itself to doing that. That project fell through. Sony actually approached him with this project based on the Ben Fountain novel, which I have not read. And he thought, I could maybe, because I've been doing all these tests and doing all this stuff, and he really feels like this is the future of film. He decided, I'm going to use it for this, both 3D and 120 frames per second, and also 4K resolution. So kind of at the top of everything in terms of the technology. Does it work? The next question.
Because it seems like, just briefly, to go from, never mind, just go from 24 to 48, but to go to 120, it feels a little like, fuck everything, we're doing five blades.
Right. It's the third heat.
Yes.
I never saw any of the Hobbit movies in 48 frames per second, so I can't speak to that. I think that it works, but I have a massive caveat, and this is it, very briefly. I wrote the review for us for The New Republic, and in the opening for that review, I mentioned the fact that a couple years ago, when I was with my in-laws for Christmas, my teenage niece had never seen Rosemary's Baby, which I am a huge fan of and have seen many times. She wanted to see it, so I said, let's watch it together. Her TV has motion smoothing on it. Motion smoothing drives me crazy, but I assumed, hey, I'm in her house. This is the way she likes to watch stuff. For the heck of it, since I know Rosemary's Baby so well, I'll watch it with her. It was incredibly weird watching Rosemary's Baby with motion smoothing. But at the same time, I noticed that it created this weird alien effect that, because I knew the movie so well, but it looked so different, that I felt like I was watching something that didn't feel entirely human. And that actually worked to that movie's advantage because it made it feel more sinister and more kind of like it increased the sense of paranoia, which is at the heart of that movie anyway. I thought about that experience a lot while watching Billy Lynn, because all of this stuff, because it's the Dallas Cowboys, let's just say that. When Billy Lynn and his troop, his squadron, goes to the halftime show, all of the stuff that goes on during the halftime production beforehand, during and after, everything there has this almost kind of like Fellini-esque effect that everything feels weird. Because of the motion smoothing effect, essentially, everything feels live and glossy and weird. And every moment that you're watching the movie, you go, this doesn't look right. And so for a lot of viewers, that is going to be a turnoff. I've talked to people who hate this movie because they hate the way it looks. I can't say I ever entirely acclimated to it, but the weirdness of it, I actually would argue, works for both all of the halftime stuff and also the flashback stuff, because we've all seen Iraq war movies. We've seen war movies in general. The simple like look of 120 FPS with 3D as well on a battlefield makes it feel more intimate and strange in a way that put me out of my comfort zone of saying, oh, I know what a war movie looks like. I know what they feel like. We talked about Hacksaw Ridge last week and how violent and bloody that is. That's a very jarring experience. Billy Lynn is its own kind of jarring experience because you can't watch the movie physically and feel comfortable with the images. I don't know if I would use this movie as a recommendation for filmmakers. This is the future. Definitely do it this way. Ultimately, I think the film feels more like an experiment than an entirely successful production. But I have to say, I felt engaged, and I very much thought about what I was watching and what thematically is going on in the movie, because it creates a sense of, frankly, PTSD, though I would never want to compare it to that because I've not experienced that myself. You do feel alienated, and you do feel like what the soldiers feel like, both on the battlefield and being back home and not understanding what is this, like what's going on in terms of how we're being treated kind of like patriotic props, essentially, and being used to sell the Iraq war to football fans back home. There is a disorientation that I think is central to the idea of what this movie is trying to do. And I think the 120 FPS works to that benefit.
Okay. One of the things that I keep hearing about this movie, excuse me, one of the things I don't keep hearing about this movie is anything about what it's about and what its story actually is. Everyone always talks about the FPS. Does this movie, and you know, it's worth knowing, not a lot of people are going to be actually able to see this at 120 right. FPS. Not a lot of movie theaters can even run that. They have the capabilities to do that. So if I'm just watching this at a regular old movie theater that's not even in 3D, and I'm just watching this on a regular, I'm not getting any of the unreality that you're getting. Does this movie, you didn't see it that way, but do you think this movie would work?
I'm very curious, to be honest. My feeling is that I think it will be okay. I think people will think it's a fine movie, but nothing more than that. It doesn't have a lot of great performances. Joe Alwyn, who is the lead who plays Billy Lynn, he's a newcomer. And you know, this is something that Ang Lee likes. He had a newcomer for Life of Pi as well. I don't think that performance is really terrific. He's supposed to be a character who's a bit kind of deer in the headlights, so it sort of works. But he is not a strong centerpiece to this movie. Kristen Stewart is okay as his very anti-war sister, but she's just fine. Chris Tucker, who plays essentially their agent, who's trying to get a movie deal for this squad, is not very good. And Steve Martin is playing Jerry Jones, make no mistake about it. It's an interesting performance, but not a great one. I think story-wise, this movie is just all right. There's not a lot new here to be said beyond the idea of, and if you are a reader of Deadspin, you would know this anyway, of course, because they talk about it a lot there, but it's this idea of, why is sports so interested in selling warfare and the military to us? I mean, that's not necessarily a new idea, but I think that is probably the most relevant, interesting part of this movie. As I said, I haven't read the book. My understanding is that the book is much more satirical and much more biting about that idea of this kid being used to sell a war, essentially. So I think the movie on its own terms, and I am actually curious to see it in 24 frames per second, I think the movie is okay. I don't think it's going to age particularly well, because I think future film students are going to watch this movie and go, well, it was used to for this like cutting edge technology, but the story itself is just kind of meh.
Yeah. All right. So that's probably enough questions I have on this movie. What'd you give it?
I gave it a B. Not one of, as a big Ang Lee fan, it's not one of my favorites of his.
All right, so there is Billy Lynn's long halftime walk. So those are the movies this week. I think it's clear you like Arrival the most. I'm okay with either Arrival or Loving. But either way, there's some movies out there to see. I have to say it's been a while, Grish, and it's been kind of nice to have that big movie that's a semi-wide release that when everyone's asking, hey, what's out right now, particularly now where people just want to go hide for a couple of hours.
Yes.
It's actually kind of nice that Arrival is that movie. I'm like, oh, you can go see this. Like, go see this. Like, I actually have a recommendation for you. I have one to go see at your local multiplex that is a good film, and you can hide for a couple of hours, which is a relief in these days. So, all right, Grayson, now we kick it off with our reboot section. The reboot movie this week is Short Term 12.
You need to get ready because it's so unbelievable. It's going to seem fake, but I promise you it's not Grace Vashborn.
It depends if you tell it right.
There is no way not to tell this right. It is a storyteller's wet dream.
Short Term 12, this is Grace. Remember, you're not their parent, you're not their therapist. You are here to create a safe environment, and that's it.
Got it.
Louise, you better be up.
So this is how it's going to be?
Short Term 12 is the debut feature from writer-director Destin Daniel Cretton. This premiered at South by Southwest back in 2013. It starred a bunch of people who are much bigger names now, including Brie Larson, John Gallagher Jr., Rami Malek, and Keith Stanfield, who I had forgotten was in this movie. It is about a group of people who work in Los Angeles, or at least somewhere in Southern California, at a facility for essentially troubled teens who are either in foster care or getting away from abusive families. And it's essentially about how that world works and the people who work there, how they do the job that they do. Brie Larson and John Gallagher Jr. are kind of the two lead counselors, if you will. They are actually dating, but they don't make a big deal out of it around the kids who are there, who are all mostly in their teens. They have a relationship. She is actually pregnant and doesn't want to tell him for reasons that will become clear as the movie goes along. He wants to get married. She seems a little less certain about that. And we just kind of spend some time with these people and the kids that they take care of. To kind of kick us off, I had actually seen this movie before. Well, you had not. And I'm curious for you, you know, what the experience was like of sort of seeing this for the first time. Because I actually have a lot I want to say, but I just want to ask you first, not to put you on the spot, of what it was like to see it for the first time.
Well, first off, there were a bunch of actors like, oh wow, you're in this. There's like a lot of those. even the woman that is I don't know if you don't watch Brooklyn Nine-Nine,
but I knew who it was. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and so like they literally like down to like very small characters in this movie. There's a ton of like, oh wow, there's that person, and of course Brie Larson as well. You know, one of the things I like a lot about this movie is it is. I don't know. I did not get a chance to research whether or not the writer and the director of the movie had actually worked in was a foster child himself, or had worked in foster care. But the movie has a clear-eyed look at foster care in a way that is still very hopeful and optimistic that I found deeply endearing. Is probably the best way to say that. This is, you know, this is a movie that understands how hard these kids are going to have it. And understands how often thankless the job of trying to help them is, but nevertheless believes in the help that they're giving. And that is that for the 15th to 22nd time on this podcast, this is the sort of thing that I need to be hearing about right now.
Yes, I have to say, he did not necessarily exactly the same facility, but did work with teenagers and had those experiences and drew from that in terms of, I haven't seen the short that this is based on, but he made a short first and then developed it into a feature. I saw this last night, and when I saw it back in 2013, I had liked it a lot and was very impressed. And My only reservation, I would say, and I think I still have it, is that I love living in the world of these characters so much that there's actually a little part of me that doesn't want it to go in what I would describe as a certain plotty direction, kind of near the end. There are certain twist is almost too strong a word to describe some of the things that happen, but I almost didn't want to be conventional or traditional at all in terms of the story that it told, because I just loved living in the world of these people. Building on what you had said, one of the things I think is really strong in the movie is that there's this idea of there are no miracles here. There is no breakthroughs. There is nothing that is going to happen here that is going to revolutionize these kids' lives and make them go down a different path or realize that they're cured in any sort of way. Because these, you know, troubled teens is such a worthless like piece of terminology, because the kids that we meet are from different walks of life and have different kind of issues. And as we'll learn as the movie goes along, some of their counselors are not that far removed from their own problems and their own issues that they are struggling with. And one of the things I just really respected and admired is that the movie is, without being cynical about it, is very clear-eyed about that this is a process and that this is no, there are no easy fixes in this movie. But with that being said, and again to mention it for the umpteenth plus one time, the thing I found incredibly gratifying about this film is that the movie says that is not an excuse not to help other people, essentially, to reach out to other people and to say, you know, if you can extend a hand to somebody else, you should do that, because you do not know what the benefit, you know, might be for that person. One of the great scenes in this movie that speaks to that in a really beautiful way is that we find out that the John Gallagher Jr. character was adopted himself, and he attends the anniversary party for his foster parents. And there are other kids there that they have also adopted. And the toast that he gives, which I find massively, massively moving, is about the idea of thank you for taking a chance on me, essentially, and saving my life in a certain way. And that is such a beautiful idea of why it's worth it to give a damn. And the movie is not sappy or sentimental about that. It's to use this phrase again, is massively clear-eyed about that may not make a difference, but not doing it will definitely make a difference, and it will adversely affect people. Like I said, there are certain plot things where I was kind of like, gosh, I almost wish it didn't have so much of a story in certain ways, because I just loved the characters in that world so much that I was perfectly happy just being in that world. But that being said, just as a quick final thing for me, you watch this movie and you think, oh, you can see the line between this movie and Room for mm-hmm. Brie Larson and what she was capable of doing. Even something that's more comedic, like the Amy Schumer movie when she plays the sister, you know. Mm-hmm. Like there is such a sense of a realness to Brie Larson that's so, so tremendous in this movie. Keith Stanfield, which when I was watching this reminded me, I need to catch up on Atlanta. I've only seen the first four or five episodes of that. Stanfield's terrific in this. He plays one of the you know, quote unquote troubled kids, and there's such a rich drawing of that character, and that performance is really, really terrific. And along those same lines, what I also really appreciate about the movie is that when the counselors like Brie Larson are trying to reach out to some of these kids who are very guarded and don't want to talk and have these kind of like this cynical armor around them, the movie figures out ways for the counselors to cut through and break through with them that feel completely believable as opposed to movie nonsense. I really, really appreciate how that plays out in this movie.
Yeah, she is the realness thing is exactly right. There's not a moment that doesn't feel sincere. And there's just never a moment where it looks like she's acting. And I know that's kind of a silly way to put it, but it's true. Like that she seems to live that. You're right. This movie's got a little bit too much. You almost wish it could almost just have been plotless. and or not entirely plotless, but just let us hang out with these people and let us hang out in this movie and have some people, because you know, really it would actually play into the message of the movie a little bit better, which is the idea that there is no A to B to C to D. And the movie feels like it keeps trying to push that on us. The natural momentum of narratives in movies is that you want to get to here, to get to here, to get to here, and ultimately you end up here. And I think one of the movie's strongest arguments is that's not how this works, and that's not how helping people works. And so therefore, I think those are going to clash a little bit in the movie. And so you're right about that. But to me, that is, it doesn't really matter, because there is there's such warmth and there's such goodness in those characters and what they're trying to do for each other. And your point is dead on. You know, you have to actually go out and help people, even if it won't actually help them.
Right.
I think that's a large portion of what the movie's trying to do.
Yeah, I have to say, you know, in comparison to Loving, I think that this does different types of things. But to me, this is an example of something that is very stripped down in a certain way, but it does have sort of an emotional payload. And I love Malick's character so much. In terms of what things you don't say when you're introducing yourself to a group of kids, you probably don't want to call them underprivileged. Over and over again, what types of movies I think people will generally respond to is movies that you feel like, I don't know this world at all, but these people do, and they're just going to show me. And this movie is a perfect example of, I don't know this world, but I have complete confidence that they know exactly what they're doing. I'll just let them show me. And the movie really nicely, almost Altman-esque, I would say, kind of says, don't worry, you'll figure it out. Just follow along, you'll figure it out. We're not going to lay everything out for you. So yeah.
All right. Well, good. Well, Short Term 12 was this is a movie that really bothered me, that had fallen through the cracks. I don't think it's a great movie, but I think it is very powerful in what it does. And I think speaks to, it's the type of movie you just kind of feel like you need.
Yeah.
At this point, we'll put it that way.
So thank you, Johnny, very much. This was a balm. So thank you. Yes.
Yes. And so you do not have to worry about handling criticism. And this is Johnny. We're not going to criticize you. Thank you for giving us this movie. All right, Kirsten, we made it through, man. We did it.
Yes.
I was a little worried.
Yes. Where were you when episode 43 aired? Yes. Yes.
Yes, exactly. So hopefully this has helped. All right, Kirsten, this has been the Kirsten Leach Podcast, episode 43. Next week, Kirsten, we got some fun ones. We got Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them, which is the eighth Harry Potter movie, not a Harry Potter movie, but the eighth J.K. Rowling movie. And apparently they're making six more of these.
Yes. And I just have to throw this in. It's part of J.K. Rowling's Wizarding World. That's the official terminology. It's their MCU-like way of defining this thing.
You just saying that made me really tired.
Yes. I apologize. But don't blame me. Blame Ms. Rowling.
Yes, I would never blame her for anything. She's a nice lady. Also, we will be talking about, and Kirsten, I don't know if you know this or not, I actually will be seeing this for us to discuss this next week. So we will be discussing Nocturnal Animals, which is the new movie written and directed by Tom Ford. It's been a while since he made his first movie, A Single Man, which is very well regarded. This one stars Amy Adams, Jake Gyllenhaal, Aaron Taylor-Johnson, Armie Hammer, and the aforementioned Michael Shannon. We'll be discussing that next week. And then I will be talking to Grierson, which I will have not seen yet, about Manchester by the Sea, which is a very high... Was that from Toronto or Sundance?
That was from Sundance.
Sundance, okay. So that's a highly regarded movie in which Casey Affleck plays a guy that's making a movie about Joaquin Phoenix. And that's that's something entirely different involving Casey Affleck.
Yes, that was a few years ago.
Yeah, he came back around. I'm still pissed at him about it.
I was going to say, the anger, listening audience, that Will still feels towards that movie, I'm Still Here, or whatever it was called, is...
Yeah, a couple of nitwits jerking each other off. Get off the stage, man. Come on. Life is short. Now more than ever. Life is short. You wasted a year and a half of your own lives on that little dork experiment. Anyway, so Manchester by the Sea. Grierson might talk about that on his own because I want to see it. And then our reboot movie next week is Children of Men, directed by Alfonso Cuarón, of course, from 2007. starring Clive Owen, Julianne Moore, a very stoned Michael Caine, and Chiwetel Ejiofor. Now, I don't know if I can...
Do you know if he was personally stoned? You're just saying the character is, yes.
He's very stoned in the movie. We were trying to figure out a good post-apocalyptic dystopia movie. I gave you three options, and that was the one that you chose.
We already discussed Fletch, so...
Yeah, exactly. Oh, God. That's one thing I could not do this week. Fletch.
Weekend of Bernie's 2. This was the week of all weeks, but yeah.
This would have been the week. Yeah. This would have been the week. All right, Grierson, we did it. We made it. Congratulations.
Yay.
Yes, we'll be back next week, assuming, of course, as mentioned next week, assuming those speaking freely are not thrown in the gulag, we will be back next week to discuss... all of those movies. Grierson, good show. We made it. I'm proud of us.
I'm very proud of us. Big hug for us. We did it.
Exactly. Be strong, America. We'll talk to you next week.
Bye.
There'll be the breaking of the ancient Western code. Your private life will suddenly explode. There'll be phantoms, there'll be files on the road. Yeah.